Good morning. So last time we started by finishing up bitwise operators. So we observed some relatively straightforward ways of solving some problems with bitwise operators, where we said, "Oh, we wanted to like combine all these bits together," and we said, "Oh, well, this we can do this, but it takes a lot of operations. Can we do better?" And we like looked carefully to see if there was some wasted work we were doing. One form of wasted work we found was sort of this distributed property. We saw an example with bitwise AND that, oh, when we're bitwise ANDing, you know, before we do everything to, you know, only keep particular bits, often it turns out that, well, you know, if we did the calculation without clearing out the other bits, we'd end up with some extra junk, yes, but we can get rid of that extra junk later instead of earlier, only do it once instead of one time for each of our sort of input values. And those other examples where you might have that sort of, you know, mathematical distributive property that helps us out. Another thing we saw is that, well, when we're doing bitwise operations, when we're thinking of doing a problem, often we think of, oh, I want to take this bit and this bit and this bit and this bit and do something with them. And the straightforward way of doing that is going to do a bitwise operation where we only really care about one bit. But that's a very inefficient use of those bitwise operations, because what the hardware is doing, well, it cares about all the bits. And it's going to give us all the bits, whether we care about them or not. So if we can take advantage of the fact that doing a bitwise OR, in fact, ORs, you know, 32 or 64 pairs of bits together instead of just one, you know, we can get a lot more efficiency out of that bitwise OR. And a common way this manifests was this fan-in pattern, that we had this sort of tree pattern where, you know, initially we're like taking pairs and then smaller values when we're consolidating down to a single answer. That comes up a lot and is very useful in, you know, making efficient use of bitwise operations, and it turns out other parallel operations. And so those were some different additional strategies we could use to, you know, make our sort of bit puzzling operations faster, you know, at least less operations. Maybe not really fast, noticeably faster, but less operations. So then we moved on from bitwise operators and talked about instruction sets versus microarchitectures. So we said instruction sets where the software interface, so that the compilers and the operating system sees from the processor. And a single software interface, as we'll learn later in the semester, has a lot of different implementation styles we could have. And that sort of actual implementation we call the microarchitecture, so that's the actual design of the hardware. And we can provide the same instructions, the same encoding of machine code, and all those details, despite having the actual way the instructions are executed being very different, which is why microarchitecture is a different thing. And we looked at some instruction set design issues. So one thing we looked at is, well, there's some big decisions which are ways instruction sets are definitely different from each other. So some instruction sets have many more instructions than others. So someone made a decision, I'm going to try to write a list of all these instructions I want, or I'm going to be very minimal, or something in between. There's also big differences in how many registers you provide, your sort of general purpose registers. When you're choosing the machine code, whether you decide that every instruction should take up the same amount of space, or you're going to have it be variable. You have that trade-off for, you know, being nice and space efficient versus making it easier or harder to encode and decode. You have a question of how many operands you want. So x86 has decided, oh, all the instructions are going to be, you know, for arithmetic are going to be two operands. Some other architectures do three. And x86's choice means we need a bunch of moves, but the instructions are shorter. You have a question of whether you want to use condition codes. We say x86 has condition codes, but, you know, there's this kind of extra register that might be awkward. You can have instruction sets where you don't do that. Then we talked about, instead of like these specific decisions, talked about higher level philosophies. And we mentioned sort of two, at least historical, maybe they're not reflecting instruction design today that much, but the pieces of them probably are the CISC versus RISC philosophy. So the sort of the CISC design philosophy seems to be focused on making a nice convenient assembly language. So we kind of like design a nice assembly language And then we figure out how to implement it in the hardware. The risk philosophy is more that we're going to expose what our hardware can do to the compiler, and the compiler's job is to take good advantage of that. So we're writing our architecture for the compiler, and we want the compiler to handle anything fancy. We want our hardware to be efficient and easy to implement efficiently, rather than having things that are complicated, because the compiler's going to like handle doing that, doing complicated operations. And this means a typical RISC instruction set is going to have fewer instructions, is typically going to have separate memory loads and stores, is typically going to have more registers. That's kind of a consequence of separate memory loads and stores. It's a way you make up for the inconvenience of that, is give the compiler lots of registers to work with, so it doesn't need to do loads and stores very often. Also, a use of space you might have been using to implement those complex instructions. And we'll look at that risk a little more when we review the quiz. But first, questions on things we covered last time. So, about wasted work in bitwise operators or these sort of high-level ISA ideas. Okay, so based on the quiz scores, I probably should go over the quiz questions. So the first question was basically asking when this first expression was going to be equal to this second expression here, for what values of x. So a way I figure that out is I first observe that, the first thing we do in both cases is we bitwise AND x with something which has zeros in all the top 16 bits of our 32-bit x value. So I only need to care about the bottom 16 bits of x. Everything else is going to be ignored. So I represented the bottom 16 bits as A through P, and I'm just writing a letter to represent each of the bits' values, sort of track them symbolically. And I said, okay, our first operation, we take our value, we end with FF0F. If we think about how hexadecimal works, this F here turns into 111, 0 turns into 4 zeros, because as far as binary goes, so we have a mask here where we're saying to keep the bottom 4 bits and these top 16 bits here, or sorry, top 8 bits here, which is why we end up with A through H, a bunch of zeros, and then M through P after that first step. Then I shift it over by 2, so I shift in some zeros and shift the O and P off and shift these zeros over, and I have this value, which I'm going to end with something where I'm keeping these two sort of nibbles, the 4-bit pieces, and this is how I get a result of, you know, 4 zeros, C, D, and E, F. Those are bits of our original number, GH from our original number, then a bunch of zeros. So I've kind of just worked out what the result of that first expression there is, sort of symbolically in terms of our original x value. So questions about how I did this, what the result means? One's comfortable. I also did this for our second value. And when I compare these two values, because that's what we did in the original expression, we asked them to be equal. Well, asking them to be equal is asking each of the bits to be equal. So we're going to need C to be equal to 0 and D to be equal to 0. We're also going to need 0 to be equal to 0. That's free. We need E to be equal to E. That's also free. So the only tricky parts are that CD, GH, and KL all need to be equal to 0 for those two things to be equal. So to make that happen, well, I look at my original number, which was, you know, A through P here. So CD, GH, and KL all need to be 0. So to test if they're zero, what I would do is I'd take this number, I'd end with a mask that selects those highlighted bits, and then I'd check that the result is all zeros. And that's what we were asking for an expression. We were asking for something of the form x ended with y equals zero. So our y is going to be this mask to select those bits that need to be zero. Everything else after we end is going to be zero, regardless of what x was. So that just checks if those bits are equal to zero, and that's exactly equivalent to checking if the expression is of those two things being equal is true. Yes? So question, why can't I set y equal to zero? So the question was asking for something we could set y to such that the set of values for which that expression was true was the same as the original. And it's true that if we set y equal to zero, that this expression is true a lot. So, but x ended with zero, this is always true. And it's even true for example, if I put a one in C. In x, right? If I put a 1 there, it's still true, and that's not true. That doesn't make the other expression true, which is what we were looking for. Or it doesn't make these two expressions I have here equal. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, what's the question asking as far as, you know, what the phrasing means? So it's saying we have this initial expression, which is these two sum expressions being equal, and there's a set of values x which satisfies that. And it's asking, we have this expression with x and with y equals zero, there's a set of values of x that satisfies that. What do we have to set y to for those two sets to be the exact same set? So it means that so we can't choose zero because that means that the set the x and the y expression is much bigger. That's not what the question is asking for them to be exactly the same, not for one to contain the other. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes, Becca? So the question is for ending with zeros. Why can't we choose one for what?
For any of the values of zero for y. Because it still gets ended with zeros and x.
Still gets ended with zeros and x. So our value of x. So the question is why can't we add. So why can't I take this value of y and add ones to it and still get the same result is your question? So remember, our value of x is this, right? So any other bit could be 1. These a, b, e, f, I, j, m, n, and o, p could all be 1, meaning that if we set that bit in y to 1, we could end up with a 1 spuriously, even though it satisfies the expression. So the only bits in y we can set to 1 are the ones that I've highlighted, which we know have to be 0. Does that answer your question? Other questions? And I guess to complete the problem, so we get this final value of y, and if I write that out in hex, I get 3330. I'm just writing out each set of four bits as a single hexadecimal number. So then let's talk about question 2 and 3. So question 2 and 3, we had this incomplete function, which I've filled in and also expanded a bit, where we wanted to do something to a 64-bit number. We did something to the most and least significant part. In particular, we swapped the most and least significant byte and then also did something to what was originally the least significant byte by flipping 2 bits. So to flip those 2 bits of the least significant byte, well, if we look up our table of bitwise operators, XOR is the way we do that. And when we XOR to flip bits, we're using a mask that specifies what bits to flip. And we want to select the first and last bit of the byte. And a way I can do that is this mask, which is in binary. You know, we have 8 bits in a byte, so 1 at either end, or in hexadecimal that turns into 8-1. And the given code, after doing that some XOR operation, move that value to the most significant part, which is where we want it in the final number, so that seems all set up. And then we also need to worry about the most significant part of the original number, which we want in the least significant part. And this step here takes care of moving it there, because it moves it by 64 minus 8 bits. And because we're dealing with unsigned numbers, we don't have to worry about shifting in ones. It's always going to be zeros because we do a logical shift with unsigned numbers. So then to combine these into our final result, we have our, what it was originally our low bit and our, originally our high bit in their right places. So we can OR those together to get them there. But then we need all the other bits of X that don't include the original least and most significant bit. So the way I select those is I need a mask which has ones in every place where we don't have part of the least or most significant byte. And this is a mask which does that. So you have 8 bytes. And I wrote ones for the parts which were not the least or most significant, and zeros otherwise. And of course, I'm doing that in binary. So to translate this to hexadecimal, all ones translates to F, and all zeros still is zero. Yes?
Is the value for B the hexadecimal digit, like 12F00, so that be the same value if the Fs were lowercase?
Question, does it matter if the Fs are upper or lowercase? No. The question is, will you get credit if you wrote it in upper or lowercase? Yes, if that wasn't done automatically, we will do it in a manual grading pass that will happen in the next week. People will look through the answers both for partial credit and also in case I wrote a regular expression that didn't handle things, which may have happened. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, other questions? Okay, so then on the questions on what is more risk-like. So we said we had these two decisions we could make in designing an instruction set and asked which would be more consistent with the risk philosophy. And I think what probably got people about this first question is neither of these seem like super consistent with the risk philosophy, but I think one is a clear winner over the other. So the first one is an instruction that finds the length of a string giving a starting memory location. And a red flag we have here is that this violates the idea of having separate instructions to access memory. Instead, we have one instruction that both accesses memory and does some computation. It's not a very risk-like thing to do, and it is a very sys-like thing to do. Also, this instruction accesses memory an arbitrary number of times. We kind of have a loop in an instruction that has unbounded length. If we think of a hardware implementation of this, probably we're doing a bunch of simpler operations, you know, in some arbitrarily long sequence, some variable length sequence to implement this. It's not really a simple hardware implementation. You know, we're basically doing some programming, you know, something relatively complicated in the hardware, which in the risk philosophy we'd say, let's leave those sorts of decisions to the compiler. The second option, you know, might seem a bit similar. We're taking a register and finding the first 0 byte in it. And this might seem like a loop, but if we're thinking of implementing this in hardware, just like when we implement kind of a bitwise AND or a bitwise OR, we probably don't need to actually have a loop to do that. This is a fixed number of operations, so we don't need to really need a loop. We can do this as kind of thinking of it as funny arithmetic, just like for doing an addition that works on a whole 64 bits. Like here, we're doing a funny arithmetic operation that works on a whole 64 bits. But it's not like, it doesn't need to be done as a loop. Like, it's just a fixed number of operations that's a small fixed number. Also, this doesn't access memory again. Like, so we aren't like combining our memory access instructions with other computation. And so I think this is a much more risk-like instruction, so it was the better, more consistent with the risk philosophy. So questions on our two sort of string-supported instructions here. Then our second question on, which was more risk-like, was if we have an increment register by one instruction, a special one with that, separate from our sort of add constant to register instruction, would that be more risk-like than saying we're going to have an add constant to register instruction, and it's always going to be the same size no matter how big the constant is? And the second, I think, is more risk-like. One thing you might remember is that I said risk typically has fixed-length instructions because that's simpler for the hardware. Another thing is that, well, you know, we just have fewer instructions. If you think of how the special increment instruction is going to be implemented, probably it's the same hardware that does the normal add constant instruction, or just exposing lots of ways to write it. And that's something that the risk philosophy avoids, that we typically try to have few ways of writing operands. Like, we don't do that thing where we have like 10 different ways of writing addresses that x86 does. We just have a few ways. So I think the second is a lot more consistent with the risk philosophy. Okay, so questions? Yes. So the question is, since risk is about sort of exposing the capabilities of hardware, wouldn't conserving memory be a virtue? And risk is concerned about, the risk philosophy is primarily concerned about performance and not space efficiency. So this has become a concern, and certainly there are lots of instruction sets which have that in mind. But typically, they're deviating from what the risk philosophy was originally focused on to do that. And you can see that when I originally described risk, risk was already making that trade-off at the beginning when they said, you know, we're not going to implement these instructions that do these loops in hardware, even though those instructions are probably, you know, a short way of writing something that does a lot. They said instead the compiler is going to write a whole loop, even though that probably takes up more space. Does that answer your question? Maybe?
I think so.
Okay. Other questions, follow-ups? Yeah.
I feel like the use of the word special might add some ambiguity there, because you don't know if that's a special case where there's some magical land where we improve the hardware, or it's just same as
in a normal condition.
So basically my question is,
So the reason I use special is just that I meant special case is what I meant. But I would say that generally sort of something that risk processors typically avoid is having lots of variants of instructions which basically all do the same thing and could be used interchangeably, just because, you know, that doesn't feel like a good use of your hardware implementation, you know, sort of effort. Yeah. The question, why doesn't it count as risk even though it's less machine code? So risk, what's reduced, is not the machine code size. In fact, risk processors compared to like SIS processors of the same era often have a larger machine code for the same program. because you have simpler instructions and you need more of them. So what's reduced is the complexity of typical instructions and the complexity of the set of supported instructions, not, you know, the size of individual instructions. Does that answer your question? Yeah, back there. So the question, wouldn't A add an extra register? My assumption for both of these, for what I'm saying to a register, is that you can specify any of the registers. So the number of registers is just like RAX, RBX, like how many of those you have. And either of these instructions could use any of the set of registers, and there's no change in how many registers there are between them. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, is there anything risk-like about the first scenario? Not really. Now, the first scenario is something that is dumb. x86 has an increment instruction. And there have been cases where a processor, which was designed with a risk-like design, said, wait a moment, machine code is too big, I need to make machine code smaller, and has implemented something like this on top of their original instruction set. Because they were really concerned about machine code size, even though sort of the original people who did RISC weren't so much. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay, so our main topic for today is going to be about the instruction set we're going to be using for implementing processors in a simulator later in the semester. This is the YD664 instruction set made by our textbook authors, and it's based on x86, but it's simplified a lot, which you're going to probably be happy for because you're going to be implementing it. So we don't have most of the 1,000 plus instructions in x86, so you don't need to spend time implementing them in the simulator. Probably will save you a lot of time. And I have the list of instructions that still exist. Also, it has a much simpler encoding. So we're going to go over how the machine code for YD6 works. It is much simpler than going over how the x86 encoding works, which like is several pages of rules. This is going to be a lot less. So here are our list of still present instructions, and I'm going to go over some of them because some of them you might not have seen before, and some of them deserve special mention. So first, one thing to note is that the CC here, that's a placeholder for some condition like less than equal, and so on. And we also have this move here, which I mentioned is renamed. So you might say, why is it renamed? What is it renamed to? And the way moves are going to be named is that we're going to have different names for different types of moves. We're going to rename with a letter for the type of source operand and the type of destination operand. And our types are going to be immediate for constant. So immediate is just another word for constant, or register, or memory. And so if we have these types, we have 9 possible move instructions. And some of them aren't actually possible. So for example, we can't move a constant into another constant. That doesn't make sense. We can't modify constants. In fact, we can't move anything into a constant. So all the I variants don't make sense. Now, we could have an instruction that moves an immediate into a memory location. In fact, you may know that x86 has such a version of move. Like, this is an instruction that exists in x86. It does not exist, there's no equivalent of this on YD664. If you want to do that, you can do that, but you need 2 instructions. You need to move a constant into a register, then move from the register into memory. And similarly, there is no instruction that moves from memory to memory. The normal x86 move instruction can't do this either, though there is an x86 instruction which can, but from YD6, don't even worry about the possibility, it doesn't happen. We want to move from memory to memory. We need to move from memory to a register, then from that register back to memory again. So questions about our different types of moves. So these move instructions that move to and from memory, those are going to be the only instructions that we use to specify a memory location and access it. So we'll talk about the other instructions with that in mind. We'll come up a bit later. So going back to our list of instructions, we have this CMOVE CC. So CC stands for a condition, like less than, greater than. And this is an instruction in XC6, but many of you probably haven't really seen it. So we're going to talk about it. This is called a conditional move. And in YD664, this is only a register-to-register move. And so here I have an example of conditional move greater than RAX to RBX. So what this does is if our condition codes, which I'm going to write as our last result, indicate the greater than condition, then we set RBX to RAX. Otherwise, we don't do anything. Another way we could think about this is that it's equivalent to writing a jump less than equal over a register to register move. So we could have written this without this special conditional move instruction. So note that this doesn't actually do the comparison itself. It just uses the condition codes to figure out whether or not to copy from one register to another. So questions on our conditional move instruction? Yes?
So before that, does it have to be like a compare or like a subtract?
So before this, do we need something like a subtract? Yes. So something needs to set the condition codes for this to be useful. Other questions? Okay. So another instruction on this list that you probably haven't seen is this HLT. So that's halt. The x86 instruction is called HLT. We're going to call it halt with the missing vowel added back in. And this is an instruction you probably haven't seen because it stops the processor. That's not something your program should be doing, typically. But for our simulator, we're going to need a way to run a program in our simulator and stop it. And so this is the instruction we're going to use to do that. On a real processor, a similar instruction exists, but it's reserved for the operating system. So I mentioned when I talk about our moves that these were the only places where we would specify addresses in memory. And there's, in fact, more rules on that. When I do specify addresses, I'm going to specify them with a displacement and a register, a base register. I am not allowed to use additional fields. They just aren't supported. So we're only going to support one version of specifying addresses, not all of the ones that x86 has. Also, these move instructions are going to be the only places where we can use this sort of syntax. This means, for example, that this add instruction from x86 doesn't work. It's not going to assemble. The only version of add that exists is going to be add register to register. That's the only version of add that YD6 is going to have, even though, yes, x86 lets you do all sorts of adds. We only have this version. So given that, what would we do to simulate this add with our move instructions? And assuming we can overwrite our 11 because we're going to need an extra register, it turns out. Yeah, question?
Yeah, so with YD6, you can't add a constant to a register.
Question, does this mean we can't add a constant to a register? That is correct, and we'll talk about that on a later slide. So I'll give you a minute to look over. Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D? Okay, so we have a split between C and D, mostly D. So I think D is right. Let's just quickly go through sort of how I'd solve this. I'd say, oh, so this add is meant to do R12 gets R12 plus memory at 10 plus R11. And the challenge is I can't just get memory at 10 plus R11, so I need some way of getting this value. So I'm looking for a move that gets memory at 10 plus R11 into somewhere, and I see I have this move here that does it, this move here that does it, and this move here that does it. The one in B, well, we're doing it after the add, so probably that's not going to be useful for adding that value to anything. And C and D, we're both doing it before the add, so that looks useful. And then we're adding it to R12, which is what we wanted to do. But in C, we're doing this extra step of also modifying it, which is not what the original instruction did. So questions? Figure this out. So that's the same. So someone asked about constants and add. So IR move Q is the only instruction where we specify a non-address constant. I say non-address because like jump We have an address constant, which we usually write as like a label. But this is the only with a non-instruction with a non-address constant, which means that adding one to a register is not a valid instruction. It is an instruction that exists. If we want to do that, we can simulate it by moving one into a register and then adding that one moved into a register with the register to register add. That's the only version of add we have. Yes?
So why is it only an add 100 constant? Like that's the only constant that
you can add? Can only add
100. And then going back to the previous slide.
This IO move Q is the only instruction with a non-address constant on operand. Is, yes. It can have any constant in there that fits in 64 bits, but this is the only instruction where you can put a constant in, so you can't put it in this add, no matter what the constant is. Okay, so one sort of overall design thing that our textbook authors did that this is reflecting is that once we know the name of an instruction in Y86, we know what the operands look like. We know what their types are, as far as like constants, registers, or memory locations. We know the format they have, their memory locations, because there's only one possibility for an instruction name. And this tells you why they split move queue into four different instructions, so that this property would still hold, even though we definitely actually need multiple variants of move. For add, they said, well, we don't really need multiple versions of add. One's going to be good enough. Okay, so questions about this uniqueness idea that once we know the name of the instruction, we know sort of the format of the rest of the operands. And a reason our textbook authors chose this property is that we'll see that when we're implementing the processor for this. This is going to make things a lot easier. Once we figure out we have an add, we don't need to worry about figuring out is it a register add or a constant add. We already know. Yeah. The question is. So the question is the source is on the left. Yes. Is this like AT&T? This is AT&T syntax still. Destination last is the rule. So this instruction here is R11 gets 1. The second instruction is R12 gets R12 plus R11. Does that answer your question? Okay. So if we go back to our list of supported instructions, we also have push, pop, call, and return, which are definitely the most complex instructions on this list. And it's probably worth talking about them, even though they work the same way they do in x86, because there's some common points of confusion there. In particular, the order in which, you know, we do arithmetic under the stack pointer versus use the stack pointer, you know, is important, so we'll go over it. So for push, we subtract 8 from the stack pointer and use the subtracted stack pointer to store the value being pushed. For pop, we access using the old stack pointer to get the value we're popping and also add to the stack pointer. Okay, so questions about push and pop? And call and return are doing pushes, but rather doing pushes of register values. In the case of pushes and pops, I should say. Call, instead of pushing a register value, it's pushing the next instruction address onto the stack and then doing a jump. Return is popping an address from the stack and then jumping to that address. And as far as what they do with the stack pointer, it works the same way as push and pop. So questions about push, pop, call, or return? So something else to talk about is sort of what storage we have in YD664. So we have registers, and we have 15 of them. And you might say, wait a moment, isn't it 16? X86-64 has 16, we're gonna have 15. And what our textbook authors did is they just got rid of our 15. Also, we're only gonna have RAX, RBX, and so on. We're not gonna have EAX, AX, the smaller parts of the 64 registers, they just don't exist. That's why you didn't see any non-Q for 8-byte instructions. We also don't have those registers, we just can't do that. For condition codes, our textbook has the zero flag, the sign flag, and the overflow flag. We're gonna ignore the overflow flag, even though that makes things wrong. We're just not gonna bother with it. Also, if you've looked at our list of instructions carefully and thought about our conditional jumps and the like, you might say, wait a moment, there's no compare. Yep, there's no compare. So if we wanna do a comparison, what we're gonna do is we're gonna do something like a subtract to set the condition codes. Our textbook talks about a stat value, which we're gonna have in our simulator, which is gonna track our processor status. Are we still running or not? This is kind of equivalent to in real hardware, like the machinery that would handle like cutting power to the machine. And also, we're gonna have a program counter, which you might have also heard called an instruction pointer, which tells us where the instruction we're currently running is, and we're gonna have a main memory. So questions about sort of our storage and our processor. Yeah.
I'm not sure if you went over this before, but is sub different from compare and compare?
The question is sub and compare different? So the compare instruction does a subtraction, but it doesn't actually modify the destination register. It only sets condition codes, so we don't have that instruction. So when you use subtract to simulate it, you have to worry about that subtract modifying the destination of your compare. So like a way you might deal with this is you might like move into a temporary register before you do the subtract. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so one way we can look at YD664 overall is basically our textbook authors took x86 and tried to make sort of a more RISC-like version. If we think about our RISC ISA properties, I've sort of highlighted the ones that definitely our textbook authors have made happen, and I've crossed out one our textbook authors really didn't make happen, and I've left as sort of in the middle things which are debatable. So YD664, it has fewer, simpler instructions relative to many instruction sets. I don't have this in red because, well, push, pop, call, and return are actually very complicated instructions relative to what RISC processors are known for doing. They're not the sort of instructions you'd implement in a typical RISC processor because, like, they add to two different registers at once, which is unusually complex. But we do have separate instructions to access memory. We don't have any instructions which both do arithmetic and a memory access. We don't have fixed length instructions, so next we're going to go over the encoding of YD6, and we'll see that it's very much not fixed length. We do have a good number of registers, just like X86 does. So 15, which is, you know, not super low, not super high. We've eliminated the x86 instructions that do things like loops. So you probably haven't seen some of these x86 instructions, but x86, for example, has an instruction that essentially does a string copy. We're not gonna have that. We don't have any instructions which access memory multiple times, have two memory operands, which x86 does have, even though you may have not seen them. They're not common x86 instructions. And also, we don't have many addressing modes. So X86 has tons of ways of specifying operands, even for just specifying a memory location. We have restricted ourselves to have just one for each instruction, which is gonna make our hardware a bunch simpler. We're not gonna have that logic to deal with decoding various different ways of writing the same value as an operand. Some questions about these properties? Yes?
Could you repeat what
Could I repeat what I'm saying about push and pop? So push and pop are pretty complicated instructions as far as RISC processors would consider. So most classical RISC designs avoided implementing instructions like push or pop, because if you think of push or pop, they access memory and they do arithmetic. Right, they're pretty complex. Other questions? Yeah.
So if RISC-like instructions that do not usually implement push and pop, how do they process all the processes?
So question, if you don't have push or pop, how do you deal with having a stack? And the answer is that instead of pushing or popping, directly you subtract and move, or add and move. Okay, so mentioned we're going to talk about encoding next. So here is a table from our textbook of the machine code format for YD6. It's showing the value of each byte separately. So our first byte is here, byte 0, and it's showing them as two digits, which are hexadecimal digits. So for example, the NOP instruction has a first and only byte of hex value 10 or 16. And our RMOVQ instruction here, RMOVQ or CMOVQ, has a first byte of 2 and something that we'll have to figure out later, and then a second byte of 2 RA and RB values we'll have to figure out later. And the instructions vary in size from 1 byte all the way to 10 bytes. We'll talk about the other fields in the instruction a bit. So each of these instructions, in the first byte, in the most significant bits, we have what's called here an opcode that tells us basically which row of the table we're in. And if we're implementing our processor, this is probably the first thing we're going to look at when we get an instruction. So that first, that most significant 4 bits of the first byte is going to tell us which row we're in, and it's deliberately, you know, set up that way to make it easy to figure out what instruction's which. So some of the instructions here represent sort of a whole bunch of instructions. So we have our conditional moves and our conditional jumps, you know, all just one row of the table, but there's lots of types of conditional moves, lots of types of conditional jumps. So we have an extra 4 bits that we're using in that first byte, which have what I might call a secondary opcode, where we decide what type of move or jump it is using this table here. And something that our textbook authors has chosen to do is they said, well, an unconditional jump or a register to register move is just like a conditional jump or a conditional move where the condition's always true. So rather than having a separate line in the table for them, we just implement a unconditional jump as a conditional jump where we always evaluate the condition codes as true. And therefore, we just have a, you know, field 0 for the type of condition it is, which just means always true. And that's what our normal jump or RMOVQ will translate into. You might also notice we have this OPQ line here. You might say, what's OP? And this is the opcode for all our arithmetic instructions. So the arithmetic instructions are all very similar. So rather than having separate lines in the table for each of them, we have one line for any arithmetic instruction, and we just specify which arithmetic operation it is with this secondary opcode, which is labeled FN for function. And we just have this table for which means which. So we have add, subtract, and XOR, all using this row of the table. So questions about our opcode and secondary opcode parts? Okay, so then we have registers. So some instructions specify registers, RA and RB, and we just have a table of register name to a 4-bit index we're going to put in our machine code to represent that register. The last, you know, several of them are pretty straightforward. The first few you need to look up in this table. Note that, so, you know, when we have two registers, like we just use all of the second bytes. We have one, depending on whether we call it RA or RB, we use a different part of the second byte. Also, something which might trip you up, we will see why we're doing this when we talk about implementing the processor, or textbook authors have chosen, and this is not a typo here, that the first register specified in MRMoveQ is RB, meaning it's the least significant part of this byte, not the most. That's a choice they made to make it access memory the same way the other type of memory move accesses memory, even though it makes it a little confusing on this diagram. So questions about specifying registers? Yes? When will we really use the none? We probably won't. You could use it to represent zero instead of a register value is probably the intention of the textbook authors, but we probably won't use it. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Where will we use no-op? The instruction no-op? Well, we want to put something in machine code as a filler for some reason. And also because it's going to be really handy for talking about implementing our processor if we start with a simple instruction like no-op and not any of the others. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. For the regular move instruction, for the register to register move, you mean?
Yeah.
What is the secondary opcode? So it's a condition code because it also could represent a conditional move. So we put a zero in there for the unconditional version.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay, so some instructions also we have to specify a constant. So we have a bunch of move instructions where we need to specify a constant move or a displacement. These are always going to be 8-byte values, and they're going to be stored in little endian, meaning the lowest address, so meaning byte 2 in this case, will have the least significant byte of that number. We also have jump and call instructions, which need to specify a constant, which is the address to call or jump to, and they're going to be stored in the same way, but in the starting at byte 1, not byte 2. Questions about constants. Okay. So, showing you the encoding here, we have a tool that our textbook authors wrote called YES, which is an assembler for Y86. So, rather than looking at this table, we can get a copy of HCLRS, which you can download from the website. You'll need it next week at least. And when you extract it, you'll get a directory. You run make. I already did it, so there's not many interesting messages. And one of the things that will exist is this program called tools YAS. And I can run that on some assembly file with the extension .ys. So here's my example assembly file. So it has a bunch of IRQ, some subtracts, jump greater than and a halt, and I can run tools YAS on it to convert it into example.yl. Now, you would think example.yl, that's an object file, isn't it? Oh, but it's not. It's more like an executable. Like, we're not going to be able to combine it with other YO files. It's just standalone execute. So, if I look at example.yo, I can see that it's not written as binary because this is meant for teaching. It's written in a human readable form, even though, yes, it's not very space efficient. And on the left side, you see we have an address, and then we have the hex values of the bytes of that address. So at address 0, we have the byte 30, followed by address 1, the byte F0. Oh, I should highlight this on the actual screen I'm using, but maybe I won't do that for logistical reasons. So then we have F0 after that, then 64 as the next byte. So the bytes are just written as hexadecimal values in order from lowest address to highest address. on the left side. On the right side, we have the assembly. When we run our simulator, we're going to load these .yo files. The simulator is not going to look at any of the assembly. It's just going to look at the numbers. Doesn't care about the assembly there. That's just for you to figure out what's going on with the assembly. Okay, so questions about using this assembler and what its output is? Yes?
What does the CAT instruction do?
What does the Oh, what is cat, the cat program?
Yeah.
It stands for concatenates. It takes all the files you provide as arguments and outputs them. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so go to the correct screen. So we had our example there. Yes, as I said, so for example, if I want to know the value at OXC, the byte at OXA is here, the byte at OXB is this one, the byte at OXC is this 01. Okay, so let's, rather than just using the assembler, let's figure out how we would assemble things by hand. So let's say I want to convert this C function into YD664 assembly, or not just assembly, machine code. I want to convert it to machine code. First step is going to be converted to assembly. So here's x86 assembly. This isn't valid YD664 assembly. The most obvious reason why is there's nothing called move Q in YD664. It has to be called something else. So what's a translation to YD664 assembly? A few minutes to look at that. Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A is good? B? C, D. Okay, so I think C and D are both valid translations. C is shorter. So D, we did the straightforward thing. We said, okay, I'm going to translate this move into the same move, but I have to rename it. This add, I can't do directly, so I'm going to use a temporary register. Turns out RDI is not being used anymore, so I can use that and do the add. In the second version, I said, oh, I can save an instruction by just doing the add in the opposite direction, and then I don't have to have a temporary register anymore. But both are sort of valid ways of doing this. And we're going to work with C just because it's less to put on the slide. So let's, now that we have chosen our assembly version of this function that actually works from Y86, we're going to translate it to machine code. So how do we do this? So we're going to take our instruction and we're going to look at our table and find the row on the table for that instruction. This is IR move Q. So I'm going to take this row on the table and that's the template I'm going to be filling in. So I have a template where the first byte is 30, then F, and I have an RB to fill in and a V to fill in, based on my instruction being V and RB. So I have that, and I've written in what goes in those slots. So for RB, I know that's RAX, so I'm going to need to figure out what the number corresponding to RAX from my table is later on. And then I have the value 1, and all our values are written as little endian numbers that are 8 bytes. Doesn't matter that we could write this in less bytes. That's not how the machine code works. It's always 8 bytes that are reserved. And here, the way I'm writing things is I'm writing the lowest address on the left side and the highest address on the right side. And I'm writing this as a sequence of bytes. So the byte with the lowest address is going to be where our least significant bit is. So that's where the 1 is going to be. Then I have 7 more bytes to finish the number, and those are all going to have zeros. So I have this partially filled in template. I also need to fill in RAX, so I'm going to go back to my table of registers here. When I see, oh, RAX, that's 0, so I'm going to put in a 0 for that. So that's what I get for my first instructions. Questions about this process? Especially the little endian part, since I know that causes problems later for a lot of people. Okay, so we have our first instruction. Then I'm just going to go on to the next instruction. That's going to appear after the machine code for this instruction in memory. So this is an add queue. So I go to my table. Now remember that add is in the op queue slot. So it's this table entry. So I know there need to fill in the number for add, the number for RDI, and the number for REX, just based on the template I had there. I look all those up in the respective table, so I have the table of the type of op queue operations, and I find out add is 0, and I have the table of registers, I find out RDI is 7, and REX is 0, so I fill in it like so. And then I go to my final instruction, which is return. I look it up in the table, I see 90, there's nothing to fill in, so I'm done. So now I have sort of my machine code from the table. I need to figure out what does this look like in memory, and we're just going to have the bytes in order in memory. On this slide, I've highlighted where each instruction begins, but in memory, that's not going to be there. There's just going to be the first byte is 30, followed by the next address F0, and so on, and there's not going to be any, you know, direct indication in memory of where the instructions start. We're going to have to figure that out by knowing how big instructions are from the table. So questions about how I did this in coding? Yes?
So the CPU, like in hardware, it just knows how long each instruction is, there's no indication.
So the question is, the CPU in hardware knows just knows how long each instruction is? Yes, and it figures that out because it's going to read this 3 here and have in hardware the information in this table that if it starts with a 3, it's 10 bytes long. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
What if, like, for the integer to register movement, we have like, something ending, the ending byte, for example, one of the instructions, like,
So the question is, what if the ending byte of like this constant resemble one of the instructions? The hardware is not gonna, is gonna know where to look for the next instruction by saying, oh, this started with a 3, therefore this is the instruction, no matter what bytes are there. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So there's not easy way for us to just know that there's chunks, you can tell which instruction.
There's not an easy way to just tell where each instruction is. Not that works all the time. If you see a bunch of 6-0s separated by 2 bytes, it might be a good guess, but that's not gonna always work. Yes. Other questions? Okay. So that's on encoding that. So also mentioned for another encoding example. So here I have a loop with a conditional jump. So the add, we fill in the table, and we find out that this turns on to 6000. For this jump greater than or equal to, remember labels represent addresses, so we need to figure out where is double till negative. And my assumption in this question, it ends up at address hex 123. Remember, we're writing that as a little endian number, and I'm writing out the bytes of the number starting with the lowest address. So the least significant part of that is the 2-3 byte, followed by a byte with the 1, then a bunch of 0 bytes. So that's what I got for this example. Questions? Yes? Question, could the constant be negative? You can write a negative constant in assembly, in which case the assembler will probably say, I assume you mean to treat these registers as 2's complement, and we'll write out the 2's complement version of that as an 8-byte number. Does that answer your question?
Once it's written in the 2's complement, it's still flip it to the
question, once it's written in the 2's complement, it'll still be as little endian? Yes. Okay, so we talked about encoding, let's talk about decoding. So here's some machine code. I have a table here. My first question is, what are the types, meaning what line in the table do we use for the first 3 instructions here? So what we should do is remember what we said is that we can look at the first part of the first byte, the most significant part of the first byte, to tell what line of the table we're in. So we're going to use that. Figure this out. So I have my machine code which starts, this is byte 0 of the machine code, then 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. Okay, can someone tell me what the type of the first instruction is? Here's the first one. Yes?
Is it RR?
It's RR, so yeah, it's either an RR or a C move. Yep, and we can tell that because we look at the first, most significant part of the first byte. It's a 2, so we look for this 2, and it must be this part of the table. And I can say that if I look at that part of the table, I have 2 bytes to fill in. So those 2 bytes are going to match up to these 2 bytes here. So I can tell from that I'm going to follow the same process for the next instruction. But I know the next instruction must start right after that. So the next instruction starts with this 6 here. So I look at the 6th row of the table, and it's some sort of op queue. So I have my opQ template, and that's going to match up. That's another 2 bytes. It's going to match up here. So questions of how I figure that out? And I keep doing that and filling in the templates, and I find out where all the instructions start. And in some cases, the instructions were a lot longer, so we had 9 bytes here, and I need to count those out. And I've marked where all the instructions start. Then our next step is going to be we're going to match up to our template the instructions, and I'm going to say, okay, I have 2010. I have 0 is the condition code. I look up in the table, and that's always. I have 1 as a register, and look up in the table, that's RCX. I just fill out the instruction that way. I keep doing this process, and I get my whole program back. So questions on this example, since we're out of time? Okay. So next time, we're going to move on from decoding to talking about implementing hardware. Also, you have a lab tomorrow, which is going to involve doing some object files, simulating object files for YAD664, and also talking about instruction set trade-offs.